First, I'll talk a little bit about non-cumulative geometry, talk about conswick and the standard model. It's going to be a little bit brief, I'm not the expert, but it's just to give you an motivation of what you do. And conswick and the standard model is a formulation of the standard model in terms of vector.
So it's really a gravitational formulation.
The standard model coupled to gravity. Essentially, it's classical, and we are interested in the kind of the question, how can you quantize it? How can you fit quantization into the framework of something done? That brings us to canonical quantum gravity and loop quantum gravity, where I'll talk a little bit about. And then the aim of the project is to find some intersection of non-cumulative geometry and elements of loop quantum gravity. So that, so it's kind of bringing together the quantization from loop quantum gravity and then the unification that occurs out in quantum gravity. And we have a specific model that we want to, that I'll present to you in some detail. That means you have a spectral triple for configuration space of connections, and this configuration space of connections related to gravity in terms of plastic and aerosol. And there, here the algebra that enters this spectral triple construction is generated by holonomy, that very similar to the loop from gravity itself. And this spectral triple is based on an ordered system of graphs. And finally, I'll give a physical interpretation of this mathematical model. So first of all, I'll show that it includes information about the Poisson bracket of general relativity, so about the kinematic part of quantum gravity. And finally, I'll show how one can construct semi-classical states, which gives you a direct Hamiltonian in space of one dimension. So first, the non-cumulative geometry is kind of a generalization of Riemannian geometry, and it's based on a dual formulation. Consider a manifold and metric, you use algebras and functions over the manifolds and Dirac operators. The central element here is the triple, which is a collection of three elements. There's a star algebra B. This is very abstract formulation. There's a star algebra B, B represents operators in the Hilbert space H. And then you have an unbounded self-adjoint operator, often called the Dirac operator, acting in H, such that these two conditions are satisfied. First of all, the resolvent of B has to be compact. So this basically means that the spectrum of this operator could be kind of nice, is a manifold. And two, the commutator D with an element of the algebra should be bounded. And this basically means that you have a first order operator. The spectral triple is a very basic mathematical object. But if there are seven additional requirements known as Pons axioms, and they're very abstract requirements, and if you spectral triple satisfies these requirements, then we call it non-commutative geometry. But the first example is actually commutative, it's Riemannian geometry itself. So if you have a commutative algebra, then you can show that this setup leads to this Riemannian geometry, and here the algebra will then be smooth functions over the manifold. L2 spinors, the Hilbert space will just be L2 spinors on the manifold, and the Dirac operator is the ordinary Dirac operator. And this is something you show, the actual input is very abstract. And Kahn, this was hard to prove, and Kahn proved it about a year ago in so-called reconstruction theorem, that there's complete equivalence between this setup of spectral triples and non-cumulative geometry and Riemannian geometry whenever it's a commutative algebra. But the central point is, of course, that these conditions, these axioms, they don't really require the algebra to be commutative, you can also just leave it non-cumulative. And this opens the door to really what is non-cumulative geometry. And here, an important example is exactly the standard model coupled to gravity. So if you alter the algebra slightly, instead of just functions on a manifold, you just add some matrix factor that looks like this, and we have a Dirac operator that acts two parts, that acts on either of these factors. And the Hilbert space is a fermionic content of the standard model. But one can extract the action of the standard model coupled to gravity from a so-called spectral action principle. There's a lot of machinery going into this, but what comes out is the standard model coupled to gravity. And I don't want to go into details, but the fact is just that this is a non-trivial result. Not all models fit into this framework of non-trivial geometry. And just the point I want to make is that that means that with non-commutative geometry, it's possible to formulate general relativity coupled to gravity, general relativity coupled to the standard model as a single gravitational model. And that's and it comes basically from an alteration of space-time geometry instead of having a function to a functions on the manifold with this matrix factor. But really, it's the non-connectivity of this algebra that gives you, goes from having just gravity to have also a Gaussian heat sector. So this is all very nice and fascinating, but essentially, it's also classical. So that's somehow the key challenge, I think, is how, what about quantum field theory? Because we know the standard model of quantum field theory. But because here it's really intrinsically coupled to gravity, so it's really gravitational, then if we somehow translate quantum field theory into this framework, which is somehow we believe has quantum gravity coming along with it. And that's the ideas we've been working on, to find some framework which just combines non-commutative geometry, the general framework and the ideas, with elements of the quantum gravity. And so some years ago we looked around for ideas and we looked at loop quantum gravity. And so loop quantum gravity, I'm sure most of you are experts, but I'll say a few details anyway. So it's a program to quantize gravity using canonical quantization. There's no unification for the program. There's a foliation of space-time, and then you use the Aztec variable. And if you have an SE2 connection related to the extrinsic curvature of this space manifold in L, and then orthonormal frame field E, identifies the five fields, given by an intrinsic geometry of C. And these satisfy the Poisson bracket, and then there are also the constraints. And it turns out it's more difficult. And then in loop quantum gravity, one shifts focus from connections to holonomies and flux variables. So instead of having a connection, you consider the degree of freedom as a holonomy along some loop or some path. And then you have fluxes of required fields of some surfaces, looking like this. So you can rewrite the Poisson bracket and you get an expression like this, where a flux variable commutated with a holonomy transform along some path here. What it's going to do is just going to insert a Pauli matrix generator at the intersection point of the surface and the path. And then in loop quantum gravity, one handles this algebra of holonomy loops by describing, by looking at a particle down to finite size. So you look at a single graph first. Because if you have a space of smooth connections denoted by A, then from the point of view of a single graph in terms of holonomies, we call that A gamma, we just consider the holonomies along the edges. Well, this is a nice space because it's just n copies of the gauge group, one copy for each of the edges. And the advantage here is, of course, that this is a manifold, so you have the harmless, and it's an easy handle object. And then you look at the full system of all such graphs. In fact, you look at the full projective system of all piecewise analytic graphs, and that gives a loop quantum gravity system of these intermediate spaces and projections between them. For example, if I have these two graphs that have four, here I have just one copy of B and here I have four. That means that the projection going the other way, if I have chosen the numbering 1, 2, 3, 4 here, it will just look like this, because the holonomies are just unified on these. And if we solve this, that if I take the completion, if I take the projection limit of this, I obtain a completion of the space of smooth connections denoted A by A, here A for piecewise analytic. And the result in, which I think is at the core of loop quantum gravity, is that the space of smooth connections is densely embedded in this here. So, so this gives access to the Aztec-Lewandowski method, such a limit of harmlessness. It gives a kinematical Hilbert space, which is a non-separable Hilbert space. And then you can kind of quantize the Poisson structure, get operators, loop and flux operators, and you can implement the constraint. I just want to point out that this program is really based on the choice of the loop algebra. And here it's chosen piecewise analytic. And this choice is related to symmetry configurations, because you want an action of the draw to be. So the project that we are working on, the aim we set out is, well, let's try to make a spectral triple for an algebra polynomial loop. That's just a crazy idea to find some intersection of these two fields. Because a loop is really a function of a space of the matrix connection into a matrix by the holonomy. And if we can make such a construction, and I'll show you how we do this, then this will be a geometrical construction over the space of smooth connections. The drag operator will be a function duration operator, and the inner product in the interface will be a function integral. It's going to be totally different kind of spectral trivial that is usually known in nonlinear geometry. It will be an infinite dimensional object. And then one part of the idea is that this should be a top-down approach. So you want to, you don't want to quantize things, you want to come up and quantize whether you find some canonical object. And we believe that, and this of course don't avoid the ambiguity of the quantization field. And we believe that spectral trivial is a very basic object, so let's try to look at it. And a key point is that we're going to use the holonomy loops instead of the trace, the Wilson loops, because that gives us a non-commutative algebra, and that places us immediately within non-commutative geometry. And then the idea is, the fantasy perhaps, is that we look for some semi-classical limit where the algebra of loops, where you will always look for kind of the manifold coming out, so you want to have the smooth function for the manifold. But perhaps a little bit of non-commutativity will be left over, and that will give you an almost commutative algebra, and that will put you in the framework of Ponsberg and the standard model. But this would, if you could get this kind of algebra, then you're close to getting something that has additional gauge in its section. So the strategy we use to, we is just taken from loop quantum gravity. So we're going to use a pro manifold structure based on smooth connections. So first at the level of one graph, this is just n copies of the gauge group, this intermediate space of connections restricted to this graph. And this is, of course, as I said, a very nice space. You can have high mesh, you can have the Dirac operator. But to construct a spectral triple at this level, it's fairly easy. Then we want to ensure compatibility with the structure maps, with projections between when you pause frame. And if you can do this, then you want to take the limit in the projective induction limits to have some construction in the limiting construction. So
I'm just going to say hand waving kind of what we're going to do, and then I'll get into some pieces around what you are doing.
So I'm feeling the hand waving motivating part of the talk. Okay, so we try to do this with the setup of piecewise analytic graphs, the kind of setup of loop quantum gravity and insane completely. The problem is that you couldn't construct a Dirac operator, a Dirac type operator, because there are too many restrictions coming from the different embeddings. But basically, the problem is the non-separability of the kinematic and heat space. You really need a separable heat space to construct the spectral trivial. So we adopt a new approach. So we consider a restricted countable system of graphs. So we want to have an ordered system of graphs to have it countable. For example, in two papers, we worked with triangulations of simplicial complexes and the bare essential subdivisions in higher, you know, you can do this in any dimension. And we also worked with cubic lattices, and I've drawn everything in two dimensions, but this is could work. Anything I say can work in any dimension. And both of these systems and many other systems permit spectral trivial construction.
I understand the problem with the non-separability of the Hilbert space comes from the fact that when I look at graphs, basically I can take a curve and subdivide it in many, many ways and get many, many graphs and so on and so forth. Yeah. So for any curve, I get too many graphs. Now, if you look at this kind of subdivisions, can you model polynomials along an arbitrary curve?
Because
as far as I see here, I see a big curve, and then I see that I subdivide that given initial curve.
I mean, of course, you do the infinity, and then it will be the
But if I start with something which does not look like that square, it's a curve which is very, very different.
Then if you start with a system that only had lines like this, for example, and went deeper, 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 then some of the results I'll show to you.
So we need that from the big if you don't have to draw. But generally, there'll be a large chart to draw. At the end of the talk, I'll tell you why we believe now that cubic lattice are kind of good. So now I'll start to describe the construction of this spectral triple. So first I look at a thinking cubic lattice in three dimensions. So we have edges and vertices. These edges are oriented. And then I look at maps, Laplace, that assign group elements to the edges. So we just take this construction also works for any compact Lie group, but of course we're probably going to focus on this group too. And the space of these such maps here is denoted by A gamma, gamma here. Then again, of course, that's just entropies of the gate group. And this will think of as a coarse-grained approximation of this space of smooth connections, something I will show later. Algebra will be an algebra of base loops, so we choose a base point, and then we consider loops in this graph. So a loop will be a sequence of edges. We discard trivial backtracking. And we have a product by just gluing them at the base point, so we just have one loop and another loop and just put them together. Because we need a star algebra, we need an evolution, so technically we just, an evolution here is just turning the loop around. And then we just define the map. Naple here also for a whole loop is just the group, the product here, the latest product between these and then we consider finite series of loops like this, and the product between them, and we can define an evolution again of these series of loops, and we have also a norm, where we here use just a matrix norm in G. So when we have a norm, that means we'll have the star algebra that we need, and we can get a C star algebra, and this would be our loop algebra that we are working with at the level of one graph. Then for the Hilbert space, there's a somewhat natural Hilbert space. Well, we produced as L2 of n copies of D with the Haar measure. That would be the choice of the loop from gravity. But we need two more factors. We need, first of all, the three-part algebra over n copies of D. So we just construct the three-part algebra over the manifold n copies of D. And then also we need a matrix factor here, where L is the size of the matrix representation of the group that we have chosen. So two dimensions of what you're going to have. And these two factors, the Clifford factor here and the matrix factor, you need them to incorporate the Dirac operator and an action of the algebra, of the loop algebra. The algebra is naturally represented just by this matrix multiply. This will be an element in the group, and we just make it multiplied on this factor here. So, for example, if I have a loop that runs like this, and I have the numbering going to the edge, it would say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, then the loop looks like this, and that means that the what I multiply with here is just this combination of two elements.
If the definition is just that on the first factor, that's the identity.
So the second factor you need for representation of that. Yeah.
And the first factor?
Because we haven't traced the whole element, so it's a matrix factor. Mm. The first factor we need for the dual operator. Because we need, it's like you have spinors, you need something that it can hit. So the Clifford one here is just constructed from the tangent of cotangent bonding, and then you have the condition of the Clifford condition. So, and now we're just at a level of one graph. So you need a Dirac operator, and at this level it's quite easy. Let's write down a
Dirac operator, just choose one, and later this will become difficult. But for now we just choose one. And that gives us a candidate for a spectral triple at the level of a graph, this graph. The next step is to consider a family of lattices. Yeah?
I mean, choose one. Can you give one example? So just to have an idea what you're talking about.
It could be, I'll show you later what it's going to be, but it could be you could take a lecture where vector field multiplied with a different, I'll come to that for the Lucy setting, the one we choose. So, you could choose one way to take the left and right vector fields and the groups. And then if it's unified, the elements of the key vector. That would be the right operator. And that's exactly. So that's the one we want to choose.
So, Rick, can you write that in more physics notation?
Well, so this would be, I mean, this is more this Pauli matrix, acting in a different way. And this would be lifted very vector fields on the groups.
And so you have this on every edge.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah, so So this would be an index for the for which copy of G you're on, and you sum all the pages. So just take a drag away of one copy of G, and then you just sum it up of all copies of G.
For each copy of G, is there one direct operator? Or
So
which one?
Okay, but I'll show you later which one to choose, because there are some restrictions that turn up later on how to construct this drag operator.
So what, here's what's interesting. If I actually take the Dirac equation and try to translate it to these variables, I need also to have the E's. To have the E's. That is, if I actually try to write the Dirac
equation. Right.
So this function is formally like a Dirac operator in a special spectral triple. But it's not actually.
So either triad fields.
Yes.
Yeah. But of course, this is different. This is on issue two. So it's a.
Right, so it's formally a Dirac operator, but it's not related to how we would express the Dirac equation.
No, I mean, I'll come back to the E's later. But in fact, these guys are going to be quantized versions of the triad fields points. But now, this will show up later, but this thing would be something like a flux scalar that's quantized.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, that's what it's going to be. So this is like a Newcomb relative where you also have the flux variables, and they are actually just lifting their negative points on various kinds of G. Right.
So you're going to explain what you mean by the Dirac operator on G. You're going to explain what you mean.
I'm going to, in some detail, I'm just going to show you, because I mean, you have Dirac operators on one point of G, and here.
Yeah, can you just say what you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Which one do you pick on G? Can you say
it? I'll come back to that. Okay. So we have a family of vertices that just look like this. And on the level of, then we have also the corresponding these intermediate spaces of manifolds with just different numbers of copies of G. And then we consider a system of spectral triplets associated to them. And the requirement that we have is that we need compatibility with these embeddings between the graphs and the field. So, for example, if I equate a Dirac operator on a state, it shouldn't matter if
I embed this your state into a higher level and equate the Dirac operator there, or at least previously, this has to be. So, it's the same kind of compatibility condition you have where you can do it. But here it's more problematic because Hilbert space in algebra is no problem, but the Dirac operator you have to be careful about.
The Dirac operator. So,
the problem boils down to this case here, where you have one copy of G, and you cut it into two pieces, and you have a projection between them that looks like this. And the compatibility condition looks like this, so it's just the Dirac operator to commute with embeddings between manifolds, as I said, between the Hilbert spaces. And this compatibility condition we worked on for some time, and there are different solutions to it. But the solution we have found. Well, we have several solutions, but one is particularly simple, and that's the one I'll show you here. So if you make a change of coordinates, instead of G1, G2, I just shift to have G1 times G2 and then G2. This will be a new coordinate. Then the structure maps are much simpler. We just forget about the second variable. And then we can write down a Dirac operator that's compatible. It will be just a sum of two Dirac operators, one on each copy of these new variables, so one on each copy of G. And then a free parameter between them. And here there's a choice of what the Dirac operator look like. So here we have an element of the Clifford algebra, and here we have left and right and left of the and the I is this is
an element of the Clifford algebra. So it's just it's more or less an Pauli matrix.
When DEI is acting on your spinner or your Clifford value function, right?
Yeah.
On the group.
Yeah.
And it gives again a Clifford value function of the group, right? No. Why do I need this EI factor?
It's just you need this, otherwise it's not a driver. It's like you need gamma matrix between them. The ordinary driver, you need the gamma matrix within it. This is more or less just a generalization of the ordinary one where you have the gamma matrix and then you have E. And you have D, and you have the lambda, and then related.
So E is valued into what, the EI, into the Lie algebra, into what? Mm-hmm.
Clifford algebra over one over T.
So that's basically it.
So which is what? The Clifford of G?
When it's three dimensional, it's just two copies of this two. So these are actually all the matrices. But on one copy of G.
And more generally, for a general group, what is the Clifford algebra for group?
So no, you have the Clifford algebra, a vector space for the norm. In general, for when the dimension is even, it's just a matrix algebra, one even, you have two problems.
So it's like, here, I'm just trying to understand the definition. So
it's like a three-dimensional.
Could you say what EI is, just to... What is your definition?
Or can you explain what CLTG is? Mm-hmm.
So that was the same problem.
Yeah, CLTG. So you take the tangent one meter, and then you impose the Clifford condition, where it's like the one you have with the anti-conductivity. And that it's just the way you build the Clifford bundle in an ordinary manifold. This is no different. I mean, it is a manifold. So it's a
Having the Clifford algebra is not enough. You have to say how it's represented, or you have to choose an ideal within it or something. What are the spinners?
I mean,
what is this accent? What is this?
The Clifford part in the Hilbert space that I wrote that before. I mean, this is just technical details.
I missed the part where you wrote down the Hilbert space.
But of course you needed to have...
Can you write down the algebra that these guys satisfy, like the index and the algebra that these guys satisfy, so that...
It's just the one you have, like the gamma matrix is mu minus...
Yeah, but here you're on the group, so it's curves.
You have to choose a matrix in the group.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Is right. The Cartan killing matrix. So which matrix do you choose, and how do you manage? Choose a symmetric matrix and...
You can just choose one that's just the right variant.
I think there's only one by invariant.
Right. So you choose this one, and then you construct this gamma mu. It's just like Pauli matrices, you will have the flat matrix.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but that's not the flat matrix you're thinking. You're thinking the current matrix.
Yeah, so you take the same condition with in this case. Yeah. I mean, normally you would have something that looks like this. And then you would have the matrix here, sitting here.
But
here in this case, you just do plotting the matrix that you've chosen, the left right there.
Okay. But can you do it explicitly? And can you find this gamma mu explicitly for this metric?
Yeah, I don't really want to write it down now.
It can be written down explicitly. Yeah. Okay, so when we do this repeatedly, so actually the important point that showed up here. There's three parameters here, so two copies, two different vectors. There's three parameters that showed up, and when we have three parameters, when we do this repeatedly, then we get three parameters we get a whole sequence of three parameters here.
I'm sorry, so you show that there are in general two types of solution, D1 and D2, that's what you're saying. That's this additional.
So the derivator that satisfies this condition is a sum of two derivators, one on each copy of these new variables. And when I do this repeatedly, then I get a series of three parameters here, and the derivator will be a sum of derivators at each intermediate limit, and then we have these three parameters waiting. And then when we take the limit of this construction, and here we're not going into any details, but then we get a candidate for a limiting spectral triple. So it's the way you take the Hilbert spaces, the same kind of limit as the kinematic Hilbert space in loop quantum relativity. And if you solve this actually is
a spectral triple, the so-called semifinite spectral triple that satisfies these conditions, and provided the sequence of parameters approach infinity, So what happens is that you have all these Dirac operators. You have the Dirac operators, the sum of all these intermediate Dirac operators for each level. And it's highly degenerate unless you push out the spectrum of this thing. And otherwise, it will never satisfy the first condition. So that's just, you only get a nice spectrum if you push out by letting these three parameters go to infinity. The semi-finiteness is a technical thing that there's a redundant symmetry. Mm-hmm.
Ambiguity amount to, is it essentially is associating a kind of metric to the lattice, and you can associate a different metric, you get a different operator? Is that the way of thinking of it? Oh.
This was the first, now I kind of constructed this thing. What is it? Can you have some physical, this is a very abstract mathematical object. The Dirac operator is a huge Dirac operator.
Can you give some kind of interpretation of it? Particularly, what about the graphs? Because as I told you, we can construct this thing for many different systems of graphs. And it's some kind of preferred system, and also this three. The sequence of three parameters. So you sort in physics, you don't want a sequence of three parameters. You want them to be fixed or something. So I think I can. I'll attempt to answer these questions in the following. So first of all, I'll just talk about the spaces of connection. So if I consider now the projective limit of these intermediate spaces and denote them a bar. So it's just it's just infinitely many copies of the group, but it's countable. But this is the same as we saw Newton's gravity before. It turns out that this is a space of generalized connections. And to see this, so that means that it has the space of smooth connections densely embedded in it. And to see this, you need to map these graphs into a manifold, so you just put them into a manifold. And then we need so there's a natural map that maps a smooth connection into this completion, because it needs to assign a group element of speed. So that's easy, because just take the holonomy along that edge here. So that's a very natural map. It turns out that this is an embedding, and in fact it's a dense embedding. But to see that it's an embedding, you just take two different smooth connections, and then they're going to differ. They're different, they're smooth and different at point, and then also different in the neighborhood of that point, and then you can just pick small edge in this neighborhood, and the holonomies will be different. Here I need, in that case, if I only have vertical, a different system of graphs, system of here some restriction to the system of graphs. So this result here, it mirrors this similar result from Lupron gravity, where one uses the system of piecewise analytic graphs. So this shows that you can capture the information of the smooth connection, the space of smooth connection, with a countable system of graphs. That means that this completion here, it contains all the smooth connections. As I said, that means that this Dirac operator is really some kind of global function duration operator. And as I said, also the inner product, it is really involves an integration over this spaces of connections. So for an interpretation at this stage, without taking anything too seriously, it looks like some non-perturbative quantum field theory thing, because it's working on infinite spaces of connections. And it looks like something between lattice gauge theory and loop quantum gravity, because it looks somewhat like lattice gauge theory, but the continuum limit is quite different. So next, I would like to talk about the interaction between the Dirac operator and this algebra of loops.
In the manifold.
The manifolds. I'm not sure I can think of.
I think when you have chosen an embedding, you've actually also chosen that vehicle model.
I see.
But it's not
I mean, the whole construction doesn't need an initial. I mean, it's just when you want to compare.
It doesn't use it, but isn't. But is it?
No, it's only when you want to compare the smooth connections. Then, of course, you need an initial. But the construction itself doesn't use it anymore. It's only when you want to compare it to something classical, then you need.
So is it one universal thing that? Maybe it's just different. I mean, I always wondered because people said that this real homomorphic structure or whatever might be playing a role in quantum gravity. And so I'm just wondering, in this it doesn't, you say, so is it like,
I mean, everything we can create, I mean, the construction here and there is basically combinatorial. So it doesn't use a manifold. But when we later construct semi-classical states, and there we need, there we're going to need. Manifold. No, but only when you compare something classical. The construction itself, the derived operator and everything doesn't need it.
Is that some kind of progress over the other formulation?
Oh, yes. You can get some.
No, I can't. Someone else can maybe do it.
Well, say it's a good thing that it's combinatorial. I mean, that means you can calculate stuff. The same, you can calculate things.
Yeah, that's it. Practical, but I meant, I just meant whether in principle you've done away with an ambiguity that is there in the other formulation.
Possibly. I don't have a good answer at the moment. So, back to this. So, I want to look at the interaction between D and the algebra. And I'm just going to recall the structure of the sum bracket between group and flux variables that I wrote down before. But I'm sure that the derived operator and the algebra groups has the same structure. So if I just commute a derived operator with one copy of G, I get this Clifford multiplication, but what I get is just a
Pauli matrix multiplied on the right side of this guy. And when I do this just for a loop with a sequence of edges, and it's roughly a sequence of G, what it's going to look like this, so I'll get commutators at each individual D. So what this means is that it means that the action of D is to insert the algebra generator at the vertices in the graph that it runs through. That's just the way it is. So this is very similar to the Poisson structure between loop and flux variables, because there you had insertion of the algebra generator at the intersection point between the surfaces and the loop. And here we have an intersection at the vertices in our graph. So that means that, so in fact, these left invariant vector fields that can be interpreted, they correspond to flux operators sitting at these vertices. So it's just very similar to the conduction of gravity. That means that this Dirac operator can be interpreted as a sum of flux operators, one for each copy of D. So this Dirac operator is really capturing the whole aspect. That's a sum of all possible flux operators in this system of graphs. It's a very big object. These surfaces, it's a sum of flux operators, but the surfaces, they're really dummy. The only thing that matters is the surface. So when I take the limit, then I get of these graphs, then I get something that looks like a representation of the Poisson bracket of general relativity. Because I get the holonomy loops and we build into the algebra, I have the flux operators in the Dirac type operator. And these objects are then supposed to be respect to the manifold and with respect to the space of smooth connections. So somehow, it's a different representation than the one in loop from gravity, which is based on two by analytic graph, but somehow we are capturing the kinematic part of the. So I'll go to the next topic, which are these semi-classical states.
The scaling parameters.
No, these ambiguities in the Dirac construction.
Exactly, these three parameters.
These three parameters.
That's some of you. So basically, the Dirac operator was a sum. It was a sum of AIs, EIs, where this is Dirac operator of certain copies of G. And these are scaling, these are just parameters. And the condition was simply that AI had to approach infinity when I. So when they, you go deeper and deeper, this so somehow the deeper you probe, the higher energy is or something like that. But of course, it, so far they're free, but I will fix them now. So the aim of single-track analysis is first of all to find states which are peaked around classical points in the phase space. But we also have the aim, we would like to have some classical interpretation of this huge abstract Dirac operator that we discussed. And here we use some results by Hall. So Brian Hall, he constructed coherent states on these compact Lie groups. So we don't need to know much about them except they localize in the groups. So it means that in the limit, I had some parameter t like h bar. When I take the limit, then this will these states localize around a certain value of g. So if I take the value of the group, we just have one value of g, and we just interpret this as a holonomy of some connection. And same with the vector field, it's just some triad. Basically, it's just give you a number, but we have the interpretation. These guys. And this is the same game that Thomas Thielmann has been doing in his analysis of single-classical analysis he's been doing.
There are two variables right there. In the Lukonen group, quite the case, the tetrad and the connection, the classical triad and the classical connection.
Yeah.
So to which variables, parameters does it correspond here?
What do you mean?
Like you were making the analogy with Thielmann states, right?
Yeah.
They have two classical values, the position and the momentum.
Ah, right. So this would be the connection, and this is a holonomy group, and this would be the momentum, the triad. It just means that we have something that's localized in the, say, cotangent bundle or a couple of people. We don't need to know too much about them, it's this fact, because we're only interested in the classical limit. So at the moment, we're not calculating the equations.
So I'm going to construct some semi-classical states that gives an expectation value of this Dirac operator. First, I'm going to take it step by step, and it's a bit technical, but and the details are not really important. But first, we assume we have, so we choose a point in space space. So we choose classical E and A field, so a triad and connection. And that's the point that we want to have something to. And then we also choose a two beam of P, which means, because P is odd with respect to the Clifford algebra, then some state that's going to be something non-zero has to make even an odd term. So for one copy of T, so I have an edge with n points v1 and v2. And so I write down this quantity here. First of all, everything is multiplied with this whole coherent state. And then I have two terms. One is even with respect to the Clifford algebra, so it's just the spin of field. This goes into this matrix part in the interface, so it fits into the interface. So we're taking speed of field at this point here, multiplied with one copy of E, so it's like a parallel transport here in the speeder. And then I have the speed of field at this point here, and multiplied with this vector here. If I go by, and then multiply with the power. And to lowest order, then this expectation value of E or this state here gives you this quantity here, which looks, don't worry about it. I expand here g as 1 plus h speed, and here the 1 here is the direction of the but one could notice in this direction we have these terms coming up, but then we have the difference between the spin of these and the two endpoints multiplied with this value here. We have also this thing coming up. So if I now said a n to be 2 to the power of 3 n, so like in the volume form, so it becomes the difference. If I fix a n to be this, and then I take the limit where I look deeper and deeper into the system, so I kind of zoom in on small x, then this thing just looks like this here. So this looks like a self-adjoint Dirac operator in the direction of 1, just one direction in the 1 thing. And this came about because I now determined the sequence. I had to fix the sequence. Next step, instead of one copy of G, I take three copies. So I have a vertex and I have three edges going out. And
how does it determine this?
Because, let's see.
So what happens is you want this to be the derivative. So this thing has to really match it. Mm-hmm. And we want the, so if you get the derivative out here, this is the covariant derivative. If you get that out, you need the A's to be taken out. So the A's have now the interpretation as the inverse for your unit.
This is so that you need lattice.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, now don't worry about the details, but this is just a generalization of what we had before. All is coherent states, and then we have even and odds.
But that's assuming that you have a flat metric on these coherent states.
So we just assume we have a coordinate system. That's going to come up. These
points are equidistant, which means they're main.
Yeah, like you have a coordinate system, you write down the relative, it's a chosen coordinate system. So we don't use a background matrix, but we use a coordinate system that we have. It's like if you write down the Einstein action in there. I'll come to that later, but it's like if you write down the expression in a coordinate system, where of course you use the derived derivative, you use the background measure given by the coordinate system. But it's not background dependent. But that comes up, that's the tricky, but I'll show you later what comes up now.
No, if you have an irregular lattice, you have to divide by some irregular factors. So.
Yeah, I'll show you what comes up.
Even if it's clear.
Yeah. In two slides, I think that can be nice. So we write on this, and if we give the
expectation value of this guy, then I get the same as before, but now just in all three directions here. And now I want to do it for the semi-classical state and the full space of smooth connections. So I write down a state here that here I have just the product of Hall's coherent states. Here I have a sum over vertices of these objects I had before. So I take the sum of all these things I had before. I'm going to be a little bit fast because I'm running low on time. So that gives us a sequence of states that go deeper and deeper and deeper in this one for each level in subdivision. When I take the limit of these guys, of the expectation value, and I take the limit where we go, the full limit of these states, then I get this expression here where I now have the invariant integral. So that's what I mean. This is an invariant integral. So it looks like the expectation value of the Dirac operator in three dimensions. And now we see that the lattices that play the role of the coordinate system. Just like when you write down a Riemannian integral, like you write it as a sum, the limiting sum over square. That's what we need. So that means that this thing, this semi-classical analysis, is really single top stupid left in some sense. I mean, we're just using the coordinate system that we used at the very beginning that we wrote down the F result. We have written down the coordinate system. So how exactly these symmetries appear and are restored and stuff, that's something we're interested in looking at. But I want to move on to something else because I would like to consider the Dirac Hamiltonian in 3+1 dimension.
Which is restored. The key issue is spatial diffeomorphism for that sphere.
Yeah.
So, at the level of the semi-classical analysis, in the limit, the limit of this expectation value becomes a spatially diffeomorphism variant.
Totally correctly. So I don't say the whole setup is invariant. You don't know that. Of course, it's a question. What about higher order terms? You don't know.
Well, right. So the original setup with the much too large space of non-separable space. What it did for us is it allowed us at the level of the kinematic Hilbert space to have an anomaly free representation of the diffeomorphism group. And so you've given that up.
Yeah. So it's a different handling of the diffeomorphism group. But we don't know if this is right, but all we know is that in this limit we kind of restore the diffeomorphism.
Oh, and only Well, you have to take the classical limits too. So it's only at the
classical limit.
At the classical level. So
but I mean, of course, you can calculate higher order terms, and I think that.
Yeah, but you don't know if this is a still a different problem.
No, that's something one has to ask. Clearly. So I'm not saying that we have a full set theory, we just have some that. But it's a different approach, and the key thing is I believe more. Sure. But I think this, if this makes sense, then we're working purely that.
Well, but you're saying it singles out. Isn't it just that cubic lattices are simpler and you're more used to
how
to
discretize and approximate?
So it's just a matter of convenience. There's nothing special about that.
Well, I mean, it's just that it's more in this analysis, we're using that they play the role of the coordinate system that we used in the beginning.
Yeah, and another lattice would play.
Of course. Yeah, so in that sense, you're right. But I thought that would be probably more complicated. But of course, yeah.
It's a matter of space, too.
Yeah. But that's true. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to show you then something. If I want to separate these things entering, we talked about these even odd states, with a 2x2 matrix, I put it in like this. So this is an R to itself beyond 2x2 matrix, and I just write it down and expand it.
So there's one for each vertex. So just expand it in terms of Pauli matrix and the identity, and suggestively I write it as N and NA, but this will be the left and the shift B. And I do the calculation again, then I get this expression out, which is a principal part of the Dirac Hamiltonian with the right terms with the left and shift B. So this suggests that these semitests and modified semitests, they look like one particle state. As one fermion state in a given foliation and given background. And the left and shift fields, they come from the state. But there's a problem here. It means if I just take the expectation value of these objects without the Dirac operator, well, I get the inner product of the spinors, but this now depends on the left and shift field, so I don't have the right inner product in this emergent filter field. And the possible solution we have a solution and we have a problem together, is to, instead of modifying the states, we want to modify the Dirac operator, because so far the Dirac operator just acts on this matrix part of the filter field. And for a long time we were wondering why not, but we didn't know what to put there. But if you simply put a matrix part into the Dirac operator here, so remember, the Hilbert space has two factors, the shift factor and the matrix factor. And so far, the Dirac operator didn't see the matrix factor, but if you just add the thing to the Dirac operator, then the expectation value of this modified thing here gives you this Dirac Hamiltonian. You have to change the states a little bit. So this seems to be a very natural object with this modification here. You just take an arbitrary action of the more of this matrix part, and that gives you exactly the left and shift, which kind of indicates that the foliation is somehow, information about the foliation somehow appears. So briefly, I just want to talk about, because of course I haven't talked about the constraints here. So this is the medical Hilbert space and the physical Hilbert space. We don't have physical states in that sense. But first of all, this Dirac operator is states invariant, so the Gauss constraint is not a problem. Second, it is possible to write in this framework down an expression which gives you a certain semitestable states will give you the Hamilton constraint. For example, if I write down something like this, don't worry exactly about it. You can just engineer this, and this will give you uncertain semitestable states. This is false, actually false. The product of all four states gives you this expression, which looks like the Hamilton and diffeomorphism constraints together. So this we can formulate, but somehow if you could be true to this initial idea, we would like something that kind of fits well into the framework of non-geometric. And because the left and shift fields appear in a very concrete way and very natural way from the Dirac operator, then one can, because I mean, we want invariance on the choice of foliation. That's more or less what we are. So, but in our case, the choice of foliation lies in this action of the Dirac operator, this matrix part. So that means perhaps a principle we should look for would be the variance of this field in this matrix. Would be if you look for states which have invariant under these guys. So if you look at how the Hamilton constraint really looks, I mean here you have these the difficulty from our perspective is that we have trial fields, for example emu and emu. But these two indices are always different because they're coupled to the field strength tensor. That means you have four terms that give, for example, one and two directions. And this is hard to get without Dirac operator. We have tried for a long time. But with the modified Dirac operators, if you take a product of these two Dirac operators, M and M, then you get such four terms. And then suddenly you start to get something that looks like the Hamilton constraint. So, I think I'm about finished. I just want to mention one or two things. Very quickly, in anatomy geometry, the spectral action is a very natural object to look at. So it's just a trace, operator trace over the heat tree of the Dirac operator. And in this case, it looks like a partition function. So it looks like a Feynman integral. You can do some tail waving happening. We know that this object is finite. We don't know exactly what it means, but we know that it's an object that really exists. And we think it would be interesting to analyze it. And we also know that this construction is well-defined in any dimension, so this thing would exist in any dimension. So there's a kind of a natural position function sitting in there. There's kind of something universal. Second final remark is that if you have a spectral triple, then automatically that means you have a matrix structure on the underlying space. So I don't want to go into details, but this means that you will have a distance between field configurations in this setup. That comes for free when you have a So, finish off. So we found some semi-classical states which kind of encode the kinematical part of quantum gravity. And we think it's interesting because it's a very basic mathematical object and there aren't that many rigorous mathematical constructions that describe infinite numbers. And this construction certainly is such a construction. Also, when you have a spectral triple with a non-commutative algebra, then automatically you have canonical additional structure. So I haven't gone into details, but in conformational scalar model, it's crucial that the algebra is non-commutative, and you get the Higgs section and the basis three more or less coming from this algebra. We don't know. So when you have the spectral triple, there's automatically more in it than just if there's gravity. There is some belief. But it will not be, we don't think it will be only gravity. We hope there's going to be some more, and that's somehow where we kind of a unifying picture. But we can't say anything concrete about this. And finally, when you have a spectral triple, well, you have finite quantities. So there's objects that you can actually calculate the matrix. Then we have these semi-classical states. Okay, I show to you, and the question, of course, is, will we interpret them as one particle space, but what about many particle space? A priori, you could just construct it, but we haven't analyzed it. It's not gonna be a soft space at some point. And of course, now we can compute quantum correction. We just put the lowest order, but we could do high order things. One thing that came out, as you talked about, so the symmetries, and they kind of they appear in this limit, and it's kind of the play between the operators and the states. So this is certainly something we have to understand better, and also if they still hold the higher order. And finally, the left and shift fields, they emerge quite naturally from the Dirac operator. So, as I said, we think, we hope it might point towards the universality question. Yes, and then the point I almost touched on before, this algebra, it doesn't really play any role in the semi-classical analysis. We don't really use it so far. And and of course it should. So the question is, well, in this limit, you have the loop algebra, but what does it give in the limit of the analysis? And of course the question is, will it be commutative or non-commutative? I mean, can you get, because of course you're always interested in the limit to get a manifold out, and a manifold in this picture would be smooth functions over the manifold. That's kind of a dual picture. But the question is, will there be some non-commutativity that will come from the loop algebra? Yeah. This is a non-commutative geometry, I mean, thing in again, Kahn's formulation of standard model, the gauge sector comes out of a so-called fluctuation of the Dirac operator using inner of morphics of algebra, and we haven't wanted to consider this too and see what it means. Finally, as the last point, I'd say, well, alternatively, one could just forget about non-commutative geometry and just formulate loop quantum gravity on this counting resistance of graph and see what it would give to. If you have something mathematically, well, it would be separable. So, first of all, this would be a different completion of the spatial smooth connections, and it would be a different approach to this more. So, it's a different set. So, I'll finish with a quote. So, from Aztec and Lewandowski, in 96, I write about the loop quantum gravity, a striking aspect of this approach in geometry of A over B is that it's generally speaking, it's the same as that of non-commutative geometry in quantum groups, even though there's no underlying differential manifold. Geometrical notions can be developed by exploring the properties of the algebra function. And I think what we're doing is just we take this quote and really try to realize it. It's really a non-commutative geometry. So, thanks.
On the precise value you choose for a n. So if it's 2 to the power cn, then you have derivatives. But you could have subleading corrections to the a n, which can give you basically anything, like very complicated terms and
yeah. We are so happy with the structure of a, because the only condition we have on a is that it shall go to infinity. And what we really believe should happen is that the true value of a should be that the a n should be just all equal to 1. Because then you will get some kind of clash between, you get something that looks a bit like renormalization. That's what we're hoping. Because then what you should have, what you do is 1 plus epsilon to the power of n, and then you have some, you would like to see some kind of renormalization in this framework. So we are not too happy with this 2 to the power 3, and we would like to do 1. But that's something we
have. 1 is already very far, but if I start from the 2 to the power cn and I ask, I say, let's say, a n equals 2 to the power cn plus 2 to the power 2n, so which is subleading, smaller, and so on.
Yeah.
This basically gives me a lot of extra terms, so I could completely lose the semi-classical.
Yes,
yeah,
so I think, if this makes sense, what we're doing, we're fine-tuning the construction using semi-classical. The construction is very general, it works in many different setups, but we're fine-tuning it using
a thing that suggests itself, if you have control over the Dirac operator in the three-dimensional version, is trying to reproduce Witten's proof of positive energy spectra as a quantum mechanical proof. Have you thought about that at all?
Well, that sounds interesting. No, I think
so. So when you said that you had this idea of reproducing the lapse and the shift from the spinner fields, did you mean the same thing that Witten used, which that is the, you have the spinner field, which is a solution of the spatial part, the spatial derivative equation, and then you construct a lapse and shift from the spinner field?
Not really. I mean, I think the right way to do it is to get the lapse and shift from the Dirac operator. So we wrote down this Dirac operator. The original Dirac operator was a sum of EI, and then the left hand vector field. But instead, then we add an action of the matrix part here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's about the beginning. So it comes with the operator. It doesn't come with the state.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't thought about this question, but it sounds intriguing.
Yeah. I mean, in some sense, what you're doing is very interesting, but the thing about what's become the standard way of thinking about loop quantum gravity solves the diffeomorphism constraint up front, and then postpones some other questions like the inner product, and which you in the space of being in the space of function to set a class point. So it's perfectly fine to reverse and sort of go back to an older point of view about lattices and regularization.
I think
it's fine to do that, but then you should get something. There should be a prize at the end. You should get something out of it.
Well, we don't have the prize yet, but of course the prize is. I can come with a few, I think, but I think one of the initial ideas is you are using the tools of non-commutative geometry. You get an element of unification in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some more structure in it. That's what we're curious about. What is it going to be? It's somewhat canonical.
So I would suggest, that the proof of positive energy translated to a quantum mechanical statement about the existence of a Hamiltonian operator would be a prize that had sort of together. Because it's something that's very hard to get in. At least nobody has succeeded in getting in the quantum gravity. It's a big missing piece, which is getting, because the positive energy, to say the obvious thing, positive energy in general relativity is a dynamical thing. It's only true on the constraint surface.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think it would really be a sense that we understood the quantization of the theory if we could implement the corresponding state in quantum mechanics.
As far as I know, no one has any positive energy theorem at all in quantum gravity. In any case, not even in semi, I don't even think there's a semi-classical positive energy theorem.
The more I think about the whole field, the more I think that this is a very important missing piece.
That's a good point. A lot of the constraints, I think somehow what comes out here, because we see the national chief coming as one thing, because it's matrix, same division. So I think what this seems to tell us is that there's a tree, Hamilton, and most constraints as one constraint.
I think that, if I'm remembering right, Ted Jacobson had a paper, maybe he never published it, sort of making a similar statement that you could combine them into one matrix.
Oh, this would interest me, because when he wrote this down, I don't think I've seen it anywhere.
I don't remember. I don't know if anyone knows if he published it, but I remember Ted showing this at a hearing of topics. It is your construction then.
So it's somehow. So we have here really this expression here, it's just putting these two things together, 2x3 matrix.
Right.
So that's different than loop congruency, but it's probably a totally different approach.
There's something I always get confused on when these spectral triples and so on come up in the context of quantum gravity. So maybe. You say that the Dirac operator acts on the Hilbert space, right?
Yeah.
So could you say carefully, what is one element, how do we think of a single element of that Hilbert space? If you want to think of it in the continuum analogy, so I'm not asking for the detail of the lattice, but if we think in the continuum, what does one element of that Hilbert space represent?
Physically.
Yeah, or math, anywhere you like to say.
Like, right down, it would have some part which is elements of the element. You would have some elements in the cliff frame, and then you would have functions or some copies of G, and then you can have you can also have some matrix parts. So,
And moreover, you should also have some over the levels.
Yeah, so then in. Yeah. Basically, what it means, it's a Hilbert space that carries a representation of this Poisson structure. And
suppose I was just doing Riemannian geometry of some fixed three manifold, then I think it would be correct to say that the Hilbert space, a single element of the Hilbert space, is just a spinner field on the manifold.
But this is a very different thing.
Can you say anything analogous?
So somehow it's not a spinner, but it's something like a spinner, but over the space of connections.
So would it be fair to say that you're trying to define a geometry on the space of connections.
Absolutely.
That is exactly what you're doing.
That is what we have a geometry. We have a metric on the space of connections. We kind of, there are some ideas going back to Feynman and people. Yes. Spectral triple is, you know, it's kind of the core of the geometry.
So, and why is that important to have that geometry?
Good question. No, but I so why is spectral true?
Or maybe we should talk about it. I'm just trying to see what physical input is being done by the dynamics geometry.
At the most general level, it gives a precise notion of what a quantum geometry is.
You're just giving structure to the space of all the.
The idea is what we're doing is we don't want to quantize something, we don't want to go classical quantum, we want to look for something canonical up here. So somehow it's pretty trivial. I mean, there are two conditions. It's a very.
So would you think of gravity, trying to think of that dynamics of quantum gravity as a kind of evolution in this space? Is that kind of sense? I'm just casting around to try and get some.
Yeah, this is to be the Hilbert space in quantum gravity, perhaps plus unification. So now it gets to, at the hand waving level, you know, the space of all metrics on S3.
Right.
I have to go on as a motivating idea, it's leading you to say that perhaps in the end, you could start from this loop algebra, all on the algebra, and you might get the almost commutative algebra out of it, like the commutative algebra of function tensorized with some fine one. But then I don't understand at all. I don't find that idea natural at all, because I'm comparing their apple and oranges. I mean, you have the loop algebra corresponds to the is about the configuration space. Why would I get the normal space time out of that? I don't understand it at all.
No. So exactly. But okay, the question that we asked, and true, we asked many questions. But the question is, in contrary, the input is very valid. It looks like this. We have many functions and many functions, we have a matrix. Why is this? Where does this come from? So this, I think we can get this out because somehow we have chosen many functions. Can we explain this part? And you're hoping that you don't have any conclusion. You're hoping that this would be related to the left hand side of the loop.
Yeah, but my problem is with the left hand side. The left hand side is not the Yohanan algebra. This is not about functions on space time. This is about functions of the configuration space, right?
So I think you cut here and say, okay, this part we probably going to say, but maybe you can kill some kind of limit with and put these together.
Yeah, I
don't know. Because, I mean, this part, when I said the simple as a limit, we choose a manifold, but if you choose a manifold, you also choose the limit. So this is.
But I think that his question is, why do you identify your initial Hilbert space with this infinity of M? Because a priori, the initial Hilbert space which lives in the connections, blah, 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 has nothing to do with this configuration space. So why do you think they are identified? I think this is this question.
Yeah, there's a difference between the configuration space consisting of connections.
You don't want to identify. You want to somehow put here and certain
limits. Yeah, I don't see the logical connection.
For the sake of. What I'm trying to say, but I'm going to put it on explaining it, but I'm trying to say, forget about this part. We just want it to be in this part. So in the limit, can we get some matrix algebra? Maybe when you freeze it, this algebra for other rooms, you get just a matrix. Maybe that could be the matrix algebra. It's just an idea.
But I think he has an interesting question there. Because you took your Dirac operator which lived over the connections, blah, 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 and you show that over a classical state it looks like the usual Dirac operator acting on simple growth. So the Dirac operator goes into what we expect. Why does the Hilbert space go into what we expect?
Why does the Hilbert space
go into some infinity of them? Or we do spinors, blah, 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 over the.
Because
Because a priori, initially, it's something which needs to do with the connections and so on and so forth, so nothing to do with the spinners over the many.
Yeah, the spinners,
They appear from this extra place, and they appear from the central part of the screw. So where does that guy correspond to a spinner in space time? The Dirac operator acting on him, we saw that acting on a semi-classical state becomes the true. So what happens is, we have the Hilbert space L2, or eight copies of G, and then the Schiffert part.
So I just write it as an L7. And then we have the matrix part. Let's see. These are the spinners.
But let's look at the first step. L2 of Gn, why does that become L2 of C infinity of?
Well, we cannot integrate out this part when we have these coherent states. We cannot integrate out this part. This is somehow left over.
Are you choosing a coherent state that's sort of concentrated around one 4 geometry or one 3 geometry? So that's how you're getting, that's how it's reducing the
car concentrates around the frame field and the connection of the geometry. But there is another strategy for unification, which is to imagine that the space of connections just has a large Lie algebra, is some large Lie algebra G, which has a subalgebra, which is the spatial SU2 plus some internal Lie nulls Lie algebra. And then just follow everything from there.
Okay. I didn't think about that.
I'm still catching up with you, I think so. Lee talked about this prize. So would one prize be that in terms of this Dirac operator, you have a very natural way to write down the constraints, and that gives them a precise mathematical meaning. That's what you're sort of aiming for, one of the things that...
Yeah, one thing you could imagine, but that doesn't work. I mean, if you write down something like this, DA, DBC, plus DAB, DC. Well, this is going to give something that looks almost like some kind of expression. but of course, yeah. We have also. I mean, there's a lot of questions. We don't have.
But again, in the few lines that make Wythe's proof of positive energy work, you go from something quadratic in the Dirac operator to something which is a linear combination of constraints plus the ADM Hamiltonian. So there is this natural, this very natural instruction to do, which is kind of a miracle. And, you know, the whole physical correctness of general relativity is somehow coded in that miracle. That is that, you know, even though there's no local Hamiltonian because of the equivalence principle, nonetheless, there's a simple, you know, expression quadratic in a simple operator, which is like the Dirac operator, which codes precisely a positive definite energy on the constraint surface.
Yeah. So something I didn't think about this. It sounds obvious to look at.
Yeah, it seems that I mean, given the tools that you have, it should just...
I can't remember exactly the difference, but don't you have to make a spinner satisfy a certain differential equation
in order
for that to work.
Right, I think. Right. So that they, I mean, the point about the positive energy theorem is that there's somewhere an elliptic equation which constrains you, which basically turns out to imply the constraints. And in that case, it is that the spinner satisfies not quite the spinner is can be thought of as a bow spinner decomposes the Dirac equation into two, so take the massless part into two bow spinners. And then it's the projection of, it's the thing which is like the viral equation pulled back into the spatial manifold. That makes sense.
Yeah. And then try to formulate that in terms of our...
Yeah, so that will also presumably give you a spectral triple with the Dirac.
Do you expect to find something like Einstein Hilbert action from the spectral action that you wrote?
Yeah. But we strongly in the beginning about this Wheeler mentioned for it.
Yeah.
Now I think we are settled on three dimensions. It seems natural that this world lives in three dimensions. And when you work with it, it seems like, I can't say it picks out three dimensions, but I think it does. So we would look for the Hamilton. But equivalent, yes. But we have objects because, of course, the spectral action is there. So what should that be? Because we saw two, well, maybe you get something coming out of them. This thing also exists. I mean, that looks like a fission function. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, we don't really know. I mean, and in mathematics, this is a. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, this is not an object that is. Normally, you don't have this kind of object. You have a manifold, and if you write away a manifold, then this is an infinite dimensional space. It's a completely different thing to get for.
This is just a number, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just one number.
It is a number, but then you could consider fluctuations of the derived wave, so within automorphisms, and then it would be interesting.
So what would that be? Deformations of the superspace of the space of stream metrics?
It's somehow, I mean, it's like you write down a more general derived operator that is invariant on the inner automorphisms. So.
But why would you want to consider fluctuations? So?
Because they're natural, and so in Kant's work, you start out with kind of the
Yeah, but in Kant's work, we're talking about the geometry of space-time, so of course we want to consider fluctuations.
So,
but here you're talking about the geometry of the space of our connections to something like this, so why would you want to?
Yeah, okay, why? It's a good question, but they're somehow naturally there. You know, this drive wave is not invariant on the inner automorphism. To make it invariant, you have to fluctuate it. So this would be like, because it's like when you add a gauge field.
So there's a connection on the space of connection?
Yes. But it exists. Mm-hmm. Well, what is it? I mean, I have no idea. But it is really the frequency, the object, I think. So what does that mean?
Okay, but we should stop here. And thank Jasper.